authors, writers, dreamers, all. Each day is an invitation to accept the call. I'm Brooke Warner from She Writes.
And I'm Grant Faulkner from NaNoWriMo. You're listening to Right Minded, weekly inspiration for writers. Hello, writers, scribes, poets, daredevils, and wordsmiths, and welcome to Right Minded, a podcast dedicated to getting in the right frame of mind to write. I'm super excited about today's podcast because one of the things that can block people from writing is grammar, a tool to guide writing, actually, but sometimes it serves as an obstacle. And we're going to talk to essentially what I view as the most famous grammarian in the world, Grammar Girl, who goes by the name Mignon Fogarty. And I'm here with my co-host, Brooke Warner. Hey, Brooke.
Hey, Grant.
And Brooke, I'm curious. Everyone has a different relationship to grammar. What are your feelings about it? Has it ever intimidated you or the writers you work with from getting their words on the page?
It for sure has intimidated the writers I work with. I think that's a big thing for people, particularly who don't think they're good at grammar or who have some sort of stuck notion that they're not good at school.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people who are just like, I didn't do well in school. And it can stick with them as another form of the inner critic. For myself personally, I've been an editor since I was 22 years old, and certainly I started out not knowing a lot, and over the years I've learned a lot. But even for myself, I spend all day with words. I think I'm a really, really good editor, but I still, and Mignon actually speaks to this in her interview today, I still don't know all the rules, and I have to look things up, and I have a brilliant editor on my staff who I probably send a grammar question to every single day just because she's closer to Chicago Manual and in there more often than me. So it's a really daunting thing to think that you can master the rules of grammar.
Yeah. I thought I was a pretty good writer and knew about grammar until I went to college. And I still remember the marks on my initial papers. And it sent me kind of spiraling because I realized that how little I actually knew. But I think I learned grammar through writing, through the practice of writing. It wasn't like I read a lot of books or learned it in the classroom. So I do think it's something that you can just learn because while you're writing, you need to reference grammar books, especially in revision.
That's an interesting thing, though, because I think what you're saying resonates for me, but also obviously reading. I think people learn to be better grammarians or just learn better sentence structure from the act of doing more reading. I'm always talking to writers that I work with about the value of learning to be a better writer by reading.
Yeah.
So for sure, it's both. And then the other thing about grammar in general is I think it's something that people can get super hung up on, like when you're saying about going to college. And I know a lot of people who then learn the rules of style, or they come from a more academic space. And then particularly because I work with a lot of memoirists, they've lost their voice somehow in that. They start to be so paying attention to the rules of grammar that they don't write how they speak. And Dani Shapiro, when talking about voice in a recent interview that I was doing with her online, was saying that she thinks voice is just courage.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved that so much because there's all these people talking about voice and, you know, it's elusive and how do you find your voice? And she was just flat out like, it's there. It's you just having the courage to write the way that you want to write. And sometimes for novelists and particularly in dialogue, obviously, that is how you speak. It's how you articulate yourself.
Yeah, you know, thank you for mentioning that. It makes me think of the author James Salter, who's one of my favorite writers. And he has a very peculiar idiosyncratic use of commas in his fiction. And the longtime copy editor for The New Yorker, I forget her name, but she recently came out with a book on her copy editing experiences. And she actually granted him his weird uses of commas because he made the point to her that they were about how they enhanced the flow and the rhythm of the sentences, even though they weren't technically grammatically correct. And that's the way I read him. His sentences have these beautiful flows, even though he's not sticking to the rules of grammar. And so I think it's important to realize or to give ourselves permission as writers that sometimes we can make grammar work for us, not against us.
Right. And it's such a huge topic. There's so much debate around grammar. And I saw Helen MacDonald, who is the author of the beautiful memoir, H is for Hawk, speak when her book came out. And I thought it was hilarious because she's British and fairly formal. Her book is very literary. And a professor of hers or someone she worked with told her that it had driven him absolutely crazy in her book that she had the audacity to split infinitives. So it gives you some sense of the range of what's okay. You know, we're talking about splitting infinitives or comma usage or, you know, anything else. And then other people who, you know, like we were saying in NaNoWriMo, might just throw grammar out the window, and necessarily so, in order to finish a draft.
Yeah, definitely. Sometimes you have to worry a little bit less about the rules of language and just make language serve your story to get out that first draft. I'm curious, Burke, so we feature a green light moment in every podcast. What's your green light moment for this topic?
I think my green light moment today has to be about the value of editors, because we're talking to Mignon, and because at the very end we're talking about the fact of, do you feel intimidated? Do writers feel intimidated, rather, by not knowing the rules of grammar? I say absolutely yes, they do. And she said something really important, which is you can hire people to take care of that for you. And I, as an editor and as a publisher, know that to be true. So I share the green light moment of one of my authors, Linda Curtis, who has a recent book out called Shunned. It's a really incredible memoir, interestingly, about leaving Jehovah's Witnesses. I had another green light moment where I talked about another woman who left Hasidic Judaism. And so apparently a lot of memoirs are about leaving fundamentalist faith. But regardless, Linda's story is a green light moment because she really did invest in herself. She decided, I'm going to hire editors who are going to look at this and make this the absolute best book that it could be. And so she had an assessment, she had a developmental edit, she had a copy edit, and she had a proofread. And in an ideal world, if you can, that is the number of edits that is merited for a manuscript. And I think there's so much value in editors. And so the green light moment is about saying yes to yourself, but putting the right team around you so that you don't get dinged later on from reviewers saying, you know, hey, you didn't go the extra mile. Grant, you're going to share with us a pep talk moment, as you do every week. Can't wait to hear what yours is.
Yeah, I really enjoyed your thoughts about getting an editor for those later stages of writing and revision. Since I focus so much on rough drafts, I like to think a lot about banishing that inner editor. And I think a lot of people's inner editor is actually created by the red marks that they've received on papers as they grew up and went to school. A lot of those red marks are telling people that they cannot write, you know, because they're about what you're doing wrong. And it's easy to internalize that and believe that you're just doing things wrong. You're not a good writer. You don't know grammar. And one thing to illustrate this that I think is, I advise everyone to do it, whether in reality or just in your mind. We ask our Young Writers Program students to actually draw a picture of their inner editor before they start writing their novels, and then to wad it up and throw it away. And so it's a tangible exercise of banishing your inner editor. And I think about this one boy, Graham's drawing, which he gave me. And his inner editor was this crazy monster with like 20 feet and 20 hands. And the reason I liked it was because it showed how the inner editor can attack from so many different directions. And his inner editor even did have a dictionary in his hand that he was throwing at him. So your inner editor can be like a physically harmful creature. But yeah, I think the notion, especially in the rough draft stage, is to not worry about that kind of perfectionism, or not worry about creativity wounds that you've experienced in your past. And those creativity wounds can be somebody telling you you're not a good writer or you don't know grammar. So draw that inner editor and then wad it up, throw it in the wastebasket, and just start writing.
Totally. And I think you could do that for any number of critics in your life, starting with the inner editor and moving on from there. So great exercise and idea. And we're going to take a short break, and we'll be back with Mignon, a.k.a. Grammar Girl.
I'm super excited to introduce Mignon Fogarty, who is many, many things. She's the founder of Quick and Dirty Tips Podcast Network, which is the home of Grammar Girl. That's right, Mignon is the Grammar Girl. She's written a lot of books on grammar. I know that she's worked on a novel during Camp NaNoWriMo at the very least. She's not just a grammarian, though. She has a background in science. She's served as a science editor and a producer at a number of health and science websites. She was a journalism professor at the University of Nevada, Reno, and she's also on the NaNoWriMo Writers Board. So welcome, Mignon. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me on your podcast.
Absolutely. So I am very curious. Your persona of Grammar Girl is huge on the internet. How did you become Grammar Girl?
Right. Well, gosh, now almost 12 years ago, I was working as a professional freelance writer and editor, and I have a degree in English, but I realized they hadn't taught me all the little nitpicky rules I needed to know to be a professional writer and editor. So every day I was looking up rules in the Chicago Manual of Style, in the AP Style book, and coming up with memory tricks to help me remember the rules. And at the same time, I started hearing about podcasting, and I love technology. And so I wanted to try this new thing called podcasting. And it just sort of seemed like it made sense to do a short, quick and dirty tip about writing and the rules that I was already looking up anyway. And I had dabbled with a science podcast before that, and was sort of looking for something a little different to do, and thought, I'll just record these writing tips I'm looking up for myself, just a weekly quick and dirty tip. And quick and dirty, it comes from when I was growing up in Seattle, my mom would say, oh, let's just do a quick and dirty job on these dishes, or let's just do a quick and dirty job and get the big weeds out of the garden, you know. And so to me, quick and dirty tips is, you know, just the basics of what you need to know. The like, let's just get the job done so you can do what you need to do. And, you know, it's scripted. It's one tip every podcast, or it was in the beginning. It's longer now, but now it's usually two or three segments. But that's how it really started. I was looking up these tips for myself. I wanted to do more podcasting, and it just came together. And much to my surprise, within 6 weeks of launching, it was number 2 at iTunes, and it just rocketed up the charts. And it really, from what I can tell, it was all word of mouth. I didn't really do anything to promote it at the time, so I just was in the right place at the right time with information people wanted. And, you know, once it started doing well, then I started working really hard to make it a business.
Well, I love that, a quick and dirty lifestyle, essentially, which is what I lead. everything has to be quick and dirty, including writing. I'm curious, since you've done so many podcasts now and written so many books on grammar, do you just know it all at this point?
No. In fact, I will sometimes I'll Google, you know, a tip and my own page will come up and that always makes me laugh. You know, I do. I look things up, you know, in my own notes, in my own books, and on my own website. There are so many rules. You know, one of my favorite reference books is Garner's Modern English Usage, and it's more than 900 pages long. Like, no, who can remember all that? Nobody can remember all that. You just need to know where you can look up things that you need to know.
That is insane, actually. And it reminds me of not only Chicago Manual of Style, which you brought up, but there's AP Style, and there's lots of different debates going on about grammar. And then one of the things, because I'm a book editor as well, is I know Chicago is constantly updating itself, and then its rules are different from one edition to the next. And so what is your position on the rules of grammar, and how do you even begin to scratch the surface of the rules changing or advise people on things that can sometimes, in fact, be subjective or changing from edition to edition?
Right. I know sometimes listeners and readers get frustrated with me because I won't give them one answer all the time. You know, and that's what people want. They want the one answer. They just want to know. But sometimes it's different in Chicago and AP. You know, I mean, a really common example is whether you put an apostrophe S after a word that ends with S. So is it Kansas's statute with an apostrophe S at the end, or is it Kansas's statute with just an apostrophe after Kansas? Well, it depends on which style guide you follow. So, you know, I often tell people that they need to, especially a professional writer, you need to know which style guide the publication you're writing for prefers. You know, and if you're an editor for a publication, you need to have a style guide for your writers so they know what rules to use. So, you know, sometimes it changes. You know, I love the American Copy Editor, the ACES meeting, the American Copy Editor Society annual meeting. One of the highlights of the meeting is when the AP style book editors announce the updates to the style guide for the year. You know, and so things change every year for AP. And, you know, if you're a professional, you just have to stay on top of that. You have to know what the new rules are and incorporate them into your workflow.
I remember one time, maybe you can tell me if this is a true memory, because when I was working at Seal Press, whichever version of Chicago we were working on at the time, it was what you were saying, the apostrophe S was the rule, and the only exception was Jesus.
Right. And I, yes, there was Jesus and Moses. and I think maybe Zeus. It was, yeah. So there were some I think they called them classical names, exceptions.
I just imagine the guys sitting around the table being like, but not for Jesus and not for Moses.
Right? Because I remember making a joke that like Jesus got dissed because they took away his S or something like that. But yeah, and I can't remember. I think maybe they've changed that now, but you know, I would have to look it up. I don't know off the top of my head, but I vaguely remember that that rule went away and now it's more consistent.
When I learned grammar, it just seemed like these rules were written in stone, there was no interpretation involved or no kind of going beyond the rules. And I know you did a TED talk on how language changes and how we essentially vote for word, you know, word changes through our usage. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about that, about how this is, nothing is truly written in stone, I guess?
Right. Well, one thing linguists sometimes give me a hard time about is that a lot of what I talk about isn't grammar. So, you know, I'm grammar girl because people think it's grammar. That's what they look for when they're searching. But it's style, it's usage, you know, it's punctuation. It's not all grammar. In fact, most of what I do isn't grammar, but it's what people think of as grammar. And that's actually an example of language changing, because grammar means something specific in the like language scholar world. But to the general public, grammar means something completely different. Grammar means, you know, the entire cloud of all the language rules that you have to know. So in a way, that's a good example of how words can change their meaning. I mean, the examples I love, if you go back 100 or 200 years and look at the things people considered wrong back then, you start feeling really ridiculous about the things that you think are wrong today, because you know in another 100 or 200 years, people are going to look back and say, what? They thought that was wrong. So, you know, an example is like, it used to be wrong to call curtains drapes.
Hmm.
Like, that was an outrage.
Like, or whom comes to mind for me, right?
Right. And people have been arguing that whom is being phased out for, you know, 50 or 100 years, that people have been predicting the demise of whom. And I do think that it is fading away more, but it's still in use. I mean, editors will still change it if you get it wrong in you know, a scholarly work or, you know, a serious novel. You know, if you're doing dialogue, and, you know, it would probably be better not to use whom, even if it's called for, because people don't really talk that way and you want your dialogue to sound natural. So, I mean, that's a good example, too. In fiction, you break the rules of grammar all the time, because when people speak, they break the rules of grammar all the time, and you want your characters to sound real and not like a computer-generated, grammatically perfect, you know, voice. And the rules that are harder to remember, like whom, are the ones that are under more pressure to go away, because the style guides reflect how language is really used. I'm trying to think of, there was an example the AP style book gave a few years ago at the ACES meeting. So the traditional rule was that you shouldn't start a sentence with hopefully, that hopefully only meant in a hopeful manner, you know, so you could say, Squiggly looked at the chocolate, hopefully. and you shouldn't, and if you wanted to say, hopefully it'll rain tomorrow, you should actually say, I hope it will rain tomorrow. So that was this traditional rule but editors always had to enforce it because people say hopefully. And the AP found that their writers were just writing hopefully so often that they finally said, look, this is common usage. We're not going to enforce it anymore. It's changed. It's not a rule because nobody does it. And so, you know, they were spending so much time, like more of their professional writers were doing it wrong than doing it right. And that's kind of the point at which they say, we're not going to do this anymore. I mean, what they say is we reflect common usage. So that's one way that language changes.
So I'm curious about your view about how grammar has been traditionally taught and how people have received it and how it's viewed in our culture.
That's so interesting. So when I was in school, I was taught sentence diagrams, for example, and I loved them. I thought it was fun to diagram sentences. And what I found is people either love it or hate it. You bring it up and people will either go on and on and tell you how much they loved it or will bemoan what a nightmare it was. So and that's really not done in schools anymore, from my understanding. And then there was this period in the 70s where they specifically did not teach grammar. And when I started the podcast, I heard from a lot of younger teachers who said, you know, I wasn't taught grammar in school, and now I'm expected to teach it. Help.
Yeah.
You know?
Listen to your podcast. That's what they should do.
Right. That is what, yeah, they would definitely what they would do. So I heard from teachers like that who listened to the podcast. And, you know, it goes through cycles where grammar isn't taught. And then I think, if I remember right, in Britain, there was a big push to start teaching grammar again. It may have been added to some standardized tests that students took. So, you know, that caused it to be of more interest to students and parents again. So it kind of goes through cycles. There are people who think that teaching grammar stifles creativity. And that's why I really agree with you when it comes to NaNoWriMo, that when people are writing the first draft of their novel, they should forget all about the grammar. Just get the story down, because that's hard. And, yes, you know, just finish the story and you can go back and edit it and fix it up later.
And what do you think about that in terms of revision, though? Because I totally agree with what both of you are saying, and I think it's such an important strategy to not have to worry about that. But because I'm an editor and because I also read a lot of people's work, sometimes it's so bad, yeah, that I wonder if you have feelings about just knowing some basics. I mean, do you think that writers should be paying more attention to their grammar at some point? I mean, is there some kind of in-between where it does matter and where the sentence structures make the reading experience more enjoyable?
Yes, absolutely. So I don't think a writer necessarily has to know all the rules of grammar and be, you know, extremely proficient at that. But if you're not, you should hire someone. I mean, you put all that work into creating this story, this novel, this piece of art, and you want to get it published. I mean, it should be in the best shape it can possibly be before you show it to someone who might publish it. So you've put so much work into it. It's worth those extra steps to make it, you know, a quality piece that isn't going to be distracting, because especially an editor is going to find errors distracting. But readers do too. And I remember hearing from a lot of self-published authors that they were getting bad reviews on Amazon, you know, because there were typos and writing errors in their books. And then once they got a little bit more successful or a little more serious, they would start hiring editors. And I think that's absolutely necessary. You can do it yourself, but if you can't, then you should hire an editor.
Hey, Mignon, speaking of novels, I know that you were working on a novel in Camp NaNoWriMo a couple years ago, maybe it was. Tell us a little bit about your writing process, especially as a grammarian, for that initial draft.
Yeah, oh, it was a disaster.
No.
It was actually really funny because I was writing and I was sharing it with my dad and my stepmom, and they loved it and they were bothering me. They're like, when do we get the next 10 pages? We want to know what happens. And then suddenly at one point they were like, whoa, that went off the rails. You know, it was going well and then it wasn't.
So no novel?
No novel. No. I mean, it's funny because I still really want to, but I'm starting to think about writing another Grammar Girl book. And, you know, I just have so much other stuff going on. And I know that's a terrible excuse because people make time. You know, people who have kids and full-time jobs still write novels. So it's not that it's not a time issue, but I think it's a mind share issue. I just don't have the mental space right now to work on that too. But I am going to someday.
Good. We will be there for you.
Thank you.
You can throw out all the rules of grammar for a month.
Yeah.
In November.
It is. It's hard for me. I get caught up in it and I get inside my head and just like any other writer. So
yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Mignon. This has been super inspiring. I love listening to Quick and Dirty Tips. I love learning about grammar and those like little tiny segments every day. It's a great way to learn. So
awesome. Thank you so much. And I just love NaNoWriMo. It keeps me inspired. So I appreciate your work too.
Great. And just to make sure everyone can find you on the internet, it's not hard. You can just Google Grammar Girl.
Right.
But you are Grammar Girl on Facebook and Twitter. You're the Grammar Girl on Instagram. And then you can find out more at quickanddirtytips.com.
Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you, Mignon.
Thanks, Mignon.
All right. Today's writing action relates to grammar, but it also relates to just writing your rough draft. And so what I'd like you to do is take 5 or 10 minutes and just write a page or two of pure stream of consciousness. It doesn't even have to relate to your story. Just write words on the page. Don't punctuate them. Make it as messy as possible. And then afterwards, I would like you to type those words into your computer and add punctuation, edit, and see how that changes the flow. See how it helps add meaning and rhythm, and see how grammar can work for you as a tool to shape your story.
Great writing action for today. Thank you so much for it, Grant. And remember, everybody, that Write Minded is a weekly podcast. So we invite you to download it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. And we'll see you next time.